Hi, this is Paul Weber. On May 12, 2009, we broadcast a live teleclass from the annual conference of the Community and Hospital Infection Control Association of Canada, CHICA Canada. The lecture was titled Ethical Decision-Making in Pandemic Planning and was presented by Professor Rick Singleton of Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland. Unfortunately, the opening comments of introduction by Marion Yetman and also the first couple minutes of Professor Singleton's lecture were obscured by poor sound quality, and we pick up with him as he addresses his second slide. This teleclass was made possible through the support of CHICA Canada and the sponsorship of Gojo Industries. The folk at Gojo have been great supporters of infection control as a whole and of the teleclass education program specifically, and I'd like to express my deep appreciation to them. Now we'll join Professor Rick Singleton and his teleclass, Ethical Decision-Making in Pandemic Planning.
I just put what I call my ethics cube here, because it gives a bit of a description of how I see ethics, or ethics in action, really, within organizations. I use it as an illustration in some of our ethics education. Some, I think it speaks to the way that ethics gets done in most organizations, that, you know, there is either implicitly or explicitly, hopefully most times explicitly, you know, vision and mission and values and those kinds of things. But the ethics action then kind of gets done on the within the different dimensions of the cube, where there are policy matters, where policies have to be reviewed and developed, where there's educational undertakings for staff and for the community and for people who participate in different ways as professionals within the organization. And then you have, particular matters of complexity where there's need for some measure of ethics consultation to either an ethics committee or to ethicists or to a group who meets to try and hammer out some of the issues and the challenges related to the matter at hand. If we were to look at that cube as something that has a bit of transparency on the sides, and you were to drop in the issue of pandemic planning into the ethics cube, you could look at the matter of pandemic planning through the policy side of it. You know, policy, or and policy in many senses, not only organizational policies, but there are laws and rules and regulations and standards and guidelines and all kinds of things in place and that sometimes need to be changed. And so the issue of review as well as development of those things are very relevant. So that's one side that you could look at the issue of pandemic planning through. You might look down to the education panel as you look into the cube around pandemic planning and see, well, there are a lot of things that people need to be educated on, including the ethical issues pertaining, or the ethics dimensions, we might say, pertaining to it. And then similarly, looking into the consultation side of it, there may be individual issues within an organization from the perspective of workers, from the perspective of clients of the organization, from the perspective of consumers, for students, regardless, and all kinds of other considerations. There may be some specific ethical issues that need to be sorted out and thought through and decisions made on and support given and what have you. So I just kind of illustrate that to show the dynamic that ethics is, as you start to look at an issue of decision-making relative to pandemic planning. And on the reverse side of it, you could say, well, and you can look at what a dynamic something such as pandemic planning is within an organization, whether it be specifically a single healthcare organization, the site of a healthcare service, or in the broader context of the healthcare system within a province or across the nation, as far as that goes. Here, an iceberg, and these are not uncommon around Newfoundland this time of the year. I've seen them on some of your own materials and in the tourism material you receive and so on. I put it here, though, as a bit of a reminder to us that when we start to look at an item and a matter within healthcare, sometimes what we're seeing is the tip of the iceberg, as we typically speak of it. And generally, people say, you know, 9 or 10% of the iceberg is what you see. The rest of it is beneath the surface, and that's always the case, or at least pretty often the case, when we're starting to examine something in healthcare. what we start to look at first is what we see on the top. It's all of the complexities beneath it. And sometimes they're pretty large, and I intentionally selected that picture with the with a boat on it. That boat would probably be about 85 feet long or so, and it just kind of gives a bit of an idea of the comparison of the size of what we're looking at. And, you know, as humans, and especially administrators, sometimes we look at it and we think we're big and powerful, but you smack a board of an iceberg and you discover that you don't have nearly as much power or capacity as you think you have. This one here is another picture out here off the harbor in St. John's, which kind of shows the size of the old iceberg as well. Just to kind of situate the discussion a little bit more before we get into the matter at hand on pandemic planning, I put it up, what is ethics in action? We could say simply, what is ethics? I just give you something to kind of ponder for a moment, a way to put what you're doing when you're doing ethics. You're trying to figure out what are the ethical issues, or how is ethics relevant to pandemic planning or decision making around pandemic planning. Well, the ethics part of it is that trying to sort out about doing the right thing and doing the thing right. But doing the right thing and doing the thing right. Later on in this presentation, I hope to focus a little bit on different types of values. Sometimes we talk about terminal values, the end value. What are we trying to accomplish? Sometimes in organizations, that would be, for instance, what we have is a vision statement that we say healthy, in Eastern Health, we say healthy people, healthy communities. Well, that's a nice value. We value that big, and we put a lot of things in place to try and deliver on that. But then there are other types of values as well that really address this issue about doing the right thing. Those are about substantive values. They're the things that are, you know, born out because of what we believe, because of what our convictions are, because of what our heritage and our culture and all of those kinds of things that inform us. They give us the substance of what it is that we think is important and, you know, what will make something right for me or for our group, whether it's the organization or the code of ethics or whatever it is that kind of informs us that what is the right thing to do. And then there are the procedural things that are important as well, the procedural values. How we go about doing a thing right is important also. And so it's about, you know, not only do you have to do what's right or do what's just, but you have to be seen to be doing what is right and doing what is just. So things such as accountability and transparency and consultation and all of those kinds of things, those are procedural values that try to give us some validity or some confidence that the way we're going about doing it is the right way, and that what we're going to do as we're doing it is do the right thing. And so both of them are important. What I find quite often, and that causes a bit of attention for people within big organizations, is that sometimes there's such a bog down in doing things right procedurally that the tension is often felt, or that gut feeling sometimes people get when, yeah, I know how we're told to do it. There's no shortage of laws, rules, regulations, policies, procedures, guidelines, codes of ethics, and all kinds of other things that tell us how to do it. But I still have this nag within me that's telling me that it's not the right thing to be doing to begin with. Interesting sometimes when you have reason to review you know, the statements that are given from inquiries, investigations of one sort or another, how often when people are spilling their guts in these interviews and so on about what went on and how this tangle came about, how often people acknowledge that, you know, when I was doing that, I didn't feel right about it. Something didn't feel right about it. You know, and that is an aggravation that goes deep within people. It's really ethics in action when people have that deep nagging sense that, you know, this is not the right thing to be doing. Quite often when people have that nag within them, what they'll do is move next step up the line and ask their supervisor who does what. Pulls out the manual or these days goes on the right site and looks up the right file in the right folder in the right server and says, oh no, this is what it says. And therefore, you get an interpretation of what that means. And so you're pushed on another few feet further to continue to do it the right way and to have an even deeper aggravation about whether or not it's the right thing to be doing to begin with. Another way of talking about what ethics is, just to kind of lay complete the flat platform, you might say, on what this stuff is about. It's to say it's the answer we would get when we raise the question, what are we doing when we do what we do? What are we doing when we do what we do? What are we doing when we decide to restrict people's liberty, when we restrict their mobility, whether that's restraining them so that they can't move around in a long-term care facility, or whether it's saying you can't fly here, there, or wherever because there is a threat to swine flu or whatever the case might be. What are we doing when we do what we do? One of the interesting challenges as we move into the ethics around pandemic planning is that it becomes bigger and more challenging because the way we look at doing what we do is a bit different than what we typically do in the context of individual client services, where we're very focused on individualized service as compared to more broad-based community healthcare needs and interests. If you're from Newfoundland, you'll recognize what this is. It's a small boat, a dory. Probably you don't have to be from Newfoundland to know what a dory is, but we'd be very familiar with them because years ago, they were quite common. Just about everyone had, at least in the small type of area that I'm from and that Marion is from, we're both from the same community in St. Mary's Bay, St. Joseph's. If you don't know where St. Joseph's is, well, you would have no reason to know where. I'd be more worried about you if you're not from here and you do know where St. Joseph's is. But anyway, it's a small community, about an hour's drive from here. But when we were growing up, just about every family had a wharf and a dory and so on, and they were great things. Now, growing up in a large family, as I did and as Marion did, 10 children in the family, so 12 in the household, we grew up in these small outports where fishing was the main industry, and, you know, everybody kind of, had very rural, self-sustaining lifestyles and so on. So when we got our holidays in the summertime, we didn't, get to go anywhere. We didn't go away on vacation, and we didn't have to wonder why we weren't going anywhere because we couldn't afford to. And, in fact, we were lucky to be able to afford to stay home, let alone go anywhere. But we... In Newfoundland, if you're not from here, it doesn't take long to discover that there are two types of people in Newfoundland. There are townies, people who live inside of the overpass, and there are baymen, people who live outside the overpass. Now, you might live 200 miles from the salt water, but you're still a bayman if you don't live in St. John's. Now, one of the things we would be a bit jealous of, I'd have to acknowledge, when we were youngsters, is that our townie cousins would have summer holidays, see? We'd get vacation from school, and that we wouldn't have to go to school during the summertime, but we wouldn't go anywhere. But our townie cousins would go somewhere on their holidays, or should I say they would come somewhere on their holidays, right? Because they'd come and they'd stay with us and with others and so on. And it was only lately I wonder who was worse off. We always thought they were so sophisticated, but they would come and stay with people who couldn't afford to go anywhere. So I'm not sure if they were as well off as they led us to believe. But they had big ways, didn't they, right? Oh, God, they were big. But anyway, why am I telling you about the dory? Because the fun we would have when we were youngsters, when we were dories, when our tiny cousins would come and they'd want to get into the dory, they'd want to go out for a row in the dory. And so you get them on the side of the wharf and they'd, inevitably sit on the side of the wharf and try and climb down as if they were going down the stairs. Well, you can't do that to climb down a wharf, as you can imagine. You get your hands behind you and you sit on the side of the wharf, take one step, and you down you go, and then you're kind of locked in position like a crucifixion, and you'd be there for some time with your bayman cousin saying to you, oh, you're some stunned, and all those kinds of things. Eventually, you'd turn them around and they'd step on the side of the dory. Well, the flat-bottom boat, of course, when you step on it, it tips, right? So then they would scream and holler and so on, and we would gently take the oar or something, smack them on the knuckles, and they would let it go, and then they would eventually, and we'd be saying all the time, and I speak fast, as you've figured out by now, but when I was 10 or 11 years old, you can imagine how fast I used to speak, so I'd be saying, get in the middle, which means get in the middle. And so with a few smacks on the knuckles and what have you, they'd eventually start to move, let go of the wharf, and the old dory would take a bob. So what would your townie cousin do? He'd leap to the other side. Or she would. Usually she's, because they always screeched louder, and that was the real fun, right? So, of course, when they'd leap to the other side, the dory would flop out to that side, and they would leap back, and this would go on. Your average townie would do that maybe 1,050 times before they would take your advice, sit in the middle. Right? What's my point, if I have one? It is that quite often it is our reaction to things is when we discover that something is off balance is to make a leap off in the other direction. We do it all the time. We do it on little things in life. You know, you step on the scales, and if the machine is still able to give you a reading and you can see it, then you decide to starve yourself. And you do that for a day or two, and then as God help the person who tries to take that, whatever it is that's laid in front of you, when you decide enough of this foolishness. And so, you know, we kind of do go to those extremes. And it seldom works. And that's part of the challenge when organizations are looking at issues around pandemic planning or healthcare planning generally. The challenge is to try and make sure that what is being considered kind of works in a balance, that it can't be all or none. So some of the principles and some of the concepts and some of the approaches to the issue of decision-making, ethical decision-making related to pandemic planning, they have to be worked back and forth quite often and viewed from different perspectives to make sure that they are, in fact, balanced and they're not just kind of reacting to one dimension or one consideration of an issue or a problem or a context and not kind of working out the rest of it. In planning and decision-making, and in any ethics work within organizations, governments included, there are really three levels at which things have to be examined. The macro level, which is the big picture, you know, the government level, federal, provincial government levels, the regional health authority level kind of thing, where you're looking at big resource allocation issues, big policy issues, big ways, you know, that involve the networkings and the collaborations amongst different agencies and what have you. The meso level is the mid-range, where you start to come into the organization, where the rubber is starting to hit the road, that you have to put structures and processes and specific resources in place to make things happen, to deliver, you know, set goals, to deliver on them, and to be measurable that the goals and the objectives and all of those kinds of things are being brought about in the right way. And then you get to the micro level, which is really pretty well the hands-on, at the bedside, in the clinic, involving the interpersonal interactions between individuals who are professionals and who are clients and who are members of care teams and those kinds of things. These are the levels at which the decision-making and the ethical issues and so on have to be sorted out along the way. What I want to take a moment on, though, is just to kind of get you folks to identify or make a comment on what would be some of the macro level issues. What are some of the big scale, big picture, government and regional health authority level issues around pandemic planning? Anyone want to identify? Pardon me?
Finally, of your ITC, we ran into that example where we had, you know, our government stockpiling such different things than we would at the region, like some of our. And that was a major issue.
Okay, interesting description of it. Stockpiling is an issue of itself, and then who and how are decisions made about what ought to be stockpiled? Yeah. Good point. Okay, others?
Funding
and when it's officially declared an emergency, those kinds of things, the status of situations and so on. Great. Other things that might be macro level.
Who's going to get health care?
Who will get health care? Oh, yeah. Now, is that, at what level do you think that's relevant?
Macro.
Macro? Does it have relevance at other levels as well? Starts to, and this is where the interaction and the collaborations and so on, it's big at macro level because it's big resource issue, big policy issues. You know, governments have to decide, give advisories and so on that trigger some of the decisions that are made further along in the more pointed areas within the delivery of healthcare. Let's take a few moments on some of the meso level. What are some of the mid-level issues and challenges? For regional health authorities, for instance.
Communicating with staff in the region.
Yeah, I'll repeat back the comments that you folks make so that those who are on the telecast can hear what you're saying. Great. Okay, with regard to meso level, I'm sorry.
Communicating with staff at a regional level.
Communication within the region. Excellent point. Others?
Guidelines.
Guidelines. Specific things in place. How we're going to do it. And that's where, you know, it has to fit into the right, in our context, our resources, our people, our sites, and all of those kinds of things. Others?
Getting healthcare workers
show up to work, yeah. How are you going to handle that whole issue of, you know, people for one reason or another, they're sick, or they refuse to work, or there's such a scare, or there's so many people in their own families and so on who need care and attention. And at the micro level, the individual patient care issues. Any thoughts, ideas? Great.
Quarantine.
Big one. Quarantine, of course, be at the other levels as well, but certainly very relevant when you restrict the individual and you don't allow them visitors and all of those kinds of things.
Triaging. Who gets the ventilator and who doesn't?
Who gets the ventilator, who doesn't? And lots of those kinds of issues. I'm just going to flick through a few that came to my mind as I was putting a few thoughts and ideas together on this one. At the micro level, or the whole issue of survival, you know, people coming forward looking for care, looking for assistance and what have you, and back to the triaging issue. Protection of oneself, of loved ones, access to care and medicines, personal and professional responsibilities, looking after your children, looking after your frail elderly parents, and those kinds of things are very, and then you have your professional responsibility to go and to provide the care and the services. One's own freedom and livelihood, whether or not you're allowed to work, whether or not you are your industry is shut down. This week there's been an interesting situation described where a pig farmer had to put down 500 animals because he was his farm is in quarantine and it's overcrowding and all of that kind of stuff. It's a big issue for that individual. Later on it becomes an issue in how, you know, does that person get compensated? So his issue should eventually, in the ethics of it all, get consideration at higher levels, especially at the meso and macro level, where there's allocations for that type of stuff. At the mid-range, the planning and preparation stuff that has to go on, the kinds of things that I suspect most of you folks are involved with in your day-to-day work. Providing care in the sense of having programs and services, infection control, safety, access to care and medications, operational logistics of schedulings and essential services, crisis response, communications, resources, employee relations, and at what point are we at breaking point? At what point can we handle it no more? It's in our situation here, of course, in Newfoundland, there's an issue about an impending nurses' strike, and so then that's an extra complication that's thrown in to the whole threat that has been relevant and was really seemed to be somewhat urgent in the last couple of weeks. And then at the big picture level is the whole issue of the public interest. What is in the public interest in managing pandemic and infections generally? Preparedness, safety, protection, fairness. Who will access care and medications? Like to your issue of ventilators or beds or whatever is needed. You have people on wait lists already waiting long time for interventions, and then things get cancelled and rooms are freed up and all those kinds of things because the pandemic is on stream and then is in the system, and we've been triggered to activate plans and that type of stuff that are going to cut off services for others. Competing interest group, and then you have all the laws, rules, regulations, the enforcement of those things, the borders, the flight, restrictions on travel and all of that kind of stuff become big issues in the at the macro level. And then the economic impact about tourism and those kinds of things. So lots of issues, lots of competing issues and competing interests. And that becomes, of course, a lot of the big challenges. When you listen to, you know, call-in shows, or you read letters to the editors, or debates that are set up in different arenas for one reason or another to debate these matters, you see that there are people with different interests. Some are strong advocates for one position or one approach, and others are taking almost a counter argument to what is in the best interest, and somehow or other it has to be sorted out. What criteria are we going to use to make decisions about these things? And that's where some of the ethics components can be of value. And the three ethics components that I think help people to move forward with trying to set frameworks for decision-making around pandemic planning and public health issues generally are deciding what are the values that we will measure by. That's one way of kind of describing what values are. You can say the values are the yardsticks that we'll use to measure whether something is right or wrong. You know, telling the truth, for instance, you know, taking in people's personal lives. Most people would value honesty. And so to tell a lie, most people would consider that, in most circumstances, to be the wrong thing to do. And so we value honesty, we value truthfulness to the point that we most times do not hesitate about declaring it wrong to tell a lie. Or honesty in the sense of stealing and so on, people would most times recognize that it would be wrong to steal. And so we have those kinds of values, and whether it's in our personal lives or organizationally as they become interpreted and what have you, we don't have much difficulty in being able to make distinctions between what's right and wrong. Well, as we get into broader and bigger issues, at macro level and meso level and so on, what values are we able to measure the rightness or wrongness by? Then what principles inform us, you know, whether or not something is right or wrong? What principles give direction to the things that we do? And so typically in healthcare, we're familiar with what's often referred to as a Georgetown mantra, the autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. And, you know, people kind of are used to using these as kind of yardsticks or principles by which we go about doing things. So we have this value, you know, to preserve life, or value, great value on human dignity, for instance. Well, the principle then is an application, really, of the things that we are going to do to achieve that value. And so, you know, I'm going to let a person make choices for themselves about what care they want, or if they want the care at all, or to what extent that they're able to select from options and to exercise their own freedom. And along with that, we want things to be in people's best interest. And so we have principles of beneficence to do good, non-maleficence to do no harm, and justice is about being fair and those kinds of things. Those are the ways that we will carry out our pursuit of the values. And then sometimes there are other ethical concepts that come into play that, you know, because of the context, because of the issue, then we start to use concepts that become very relevant to our discussions. And so things such as best interest and compassion and all of those types of things become relevant as well. The challenge, as I've commented on a moment ago, is to kind of retrain ourselves to some extent when we're talking about issues of public health, to shift away from the way that we look at matters of individual healthcare decision making. Generally, people these days are familiar with what's referred to as the Georgetown mantra. It came out of a particular set of writings from Georgetown University. Well, those four principles that I just mentioned and that are on the slide here, autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice, these are kind of good kind of ethics first aid. But primarily they are focused on the decision-making relevant to, on one hand, individual clinical matters, the care of individual patients and people's decisions about their own health care. And the other is the consideration in light of healthcare research. And so people making choices for themselves, what's in their best interest in terms of doing good and not doing harm, and being fair to the person and to the group is part of, you know, it's our way of looking at it. What happens, though, when we come to the public health domain is that those principles are not the direction, because they are very focused on the individual end of it. And public health issues, such as pandemic planning and what have you, are not about the interest of the one. They are not about the interest of the individual. They are the interest of the common good or of the broader community. It's an old story that I and others use to illustrate the point and the challenge in healthcare ethics and in dealing with individual cases as compared to doing to dealing with the broader interest of more people and the common good. And it's kind of a parable type story of a farmer and his son who are working on their farm, and there's a big rainstorm, and as they're working on the farm and looking out and the river that flows along at the bottom of the meadow, they notice something coming along, and they go to look, and they discover that it's a person. And so the farmer and his son manage to get out into the river far enough to grab the person and haul the person in, and they save the person. And then they notice that there's another something coming along, and it's another person, and as the story goes, they notice that there's a steady stream of people coming down the river. And eventually one of the people that they pulled out of the river said, the bridge is washed out, and when people come over the hill or around the corner, the turn or what have you, they don't realize the bridge is gone, and they drive out into the river. So what should the farmer, or what will the farmer and the son need to do or want to do? Will they continue to stay there to pull people out of the river, or will they stop trying to pull individuals out of the river and go up and bar off the road so that people won't be driving out into the river? That parable is simplistic in many ways, as am I, but along with it, it kind of makes the point that choices have to be made sometimes about what is in the individual best interest as compared to what's in the best interest of many people or the broader community in general. Sometimes when I'm using that with students and I want to kill a bit of time in class, I'll throw in a few other twists on it, such as the farmer knows that his wife and his daughter have gone shopping and they are coming home that way. Are they going to take the risk that they will come and drive into the river and we won't be here to pull them out when they come? Or will they take the risk that if we race up there, maybe we'll get the bar off the road before mom and sis gets there? Well, you can imagine the discussion that gets going with second and third year students. They will debate it forever and all the possible twists that we can throw into it. The shift from the individual to the common good is as listed here. And the individual, the focus is on my health, my risks and benefits, my choice and my best interest. The common good interest, community interest of the of public health is about populations, and it's about communities, and it's about reducing inequities and inequalities and protecting the vulnerable, and it's about collaborative action where that involves networks of people and groups, and that is not just an individual or a small group of care providers and a single client or a single family. It's bigger and broader and much more collaborative than that. I mentioned a little while ago about values, and there are different types, and sometimes that's a worthwhile bit of a distinction to make for ourselves and for others when we're talking about the decision-making processes around planning and public health and so on, that there are the end values, you know, the healthy people, healthy communities kind of value that are big, broad statements about what it is we want to achieve when it's all said and done, and then there are the core belief, convictions, kind of values that lead us to be informed or to inform ourselves and try at times to inform or convince others, persuade others that this is the right or best thing to do. And then there are the procedural ones. How do we go about doing this stuff? Because these days, and quite rightly so, there's a bit of resistance to informed people going into closets or other places and making a set of policies or rules or regulations that impact the lives of others without adequate consultation with the people who are going to be most impacted by these laws or rules or regulations. So then the procedural values are important to people, especially in the public domain. I have here on the slide, and it's a chance, I'm not sure if people who are on by teleconference can see this one, but it just kind of identifies some of the factors that are relevant to the different types of values, and it's essentially what I just mentioned. I will mention, though, that the, and this is from the descriptions that are given in the document prepared by the Joint Center for Bioethics in Toronto. Their document, Stand on Guard for These, an excellent document, an excellent resource for anyone who is interested in reading about the ethical issues and challenges around pandemic planning. They did a lot of work, a lot of marvelous work, with marvelous resource people involved in it subsequent to the SARS outbreak, and that work actually is foundational to most organizations that are putting that are working on pandemic planning and putting an ethics framework in place. But in that, they describe the substantive values, the criteria in decision-making to do the right thing, as there are things that are relevant are about individual liberty, protection of the public from harm, proportionality, that is that the, you know, restrictions that are put in place must be in proportion to the risk that is at hand. Privacy, duty to provide care, reciprocity. The reciprocity one is that people who are most inconvenienced, or people who have to surrender the most of their own service because of regulations that are put in place, ought to receive some proportional compensation or accommodation. For instance, people who have to work during an outbreak of some sort or other, they ought to be given considerations that are in somehow or other in proportion to what it is that they are contributing to managing this crisis situation. What's interesting is sometimes people will be delighted to draw upon the services of people who provide that type of care during a time of crisis of one sort or another, but then when it comes to the reciprocity end of it, they would be inclined to say, no, everybody's got to be treated fairly and so on. Just recently, I'm in an interesting discussion somewhat similar to that about a no-smoking policy and whether or not it can be imposed on veterans, for instance, in the Veterans Pavilion. It's a kind of related subject matter. Other things are about equity, trust, solidarity, and stewardship, and then their procedural values, as I mentioned. To wrap up, there are a few, largely four main ethical issues that are to be considered, and that people have to find a balance on them in pandemic planning and to make sure you use an ethics framework. First one, healthcare workers' responsibility and obligation to provide care during the time of communicable illness crisis. The individual's responsibilities and duties to provide care. That's something that has to be sorted out one way or another. There's lots of things there in contracts and in working agreements and codes of ethics and so on that inform it, but the individual ultimately has to make the choice. Restricting liberty in the interest of infection prevention and control. Liberties to travel, to move around, liberty around the people assembling, and privacy. Those are big issues around infection control matters, especially around major outbreaks, pandemic planning, and what have you. Priority setting, including the allocation of scarce resources such as vaccines and antivirals, as well as resources within the organization when people have to be hospitalized or need services through ER and surgeries and what have you. These are things, there have to be some criteria put in place by which people make decisions. It can't be a matter of an individual showing up and trying to convince the individual practitioner, or call open line shows, which is a strategy often used in our province, or calling the politician, which is another strategy that's often used. And then the global governance implications, such as travel advisories and the things that happen at a higher level, they have big impacts on people whose jobs are put in jeopardy, whose incomes are put in jeopardy, and as well as other social factors that are of major relevance. And then a couple of other things are about research that would need to take place before, during, or after pandemics, the treatment of animals, especially culling, and fairness, as I mentioned before, to people whose businesses are jeopardized or their incomes. To wrap up, the two things that I say that ethics is about are doing the right thing and doing the thing right, or what are we doing when we do what we do? That's when we're doing ethics. It isn't something that's specialized or that you're, where you're poked off in a room or at a table or at a Congress where it's all decided by experts. Every one of you do ethics every day. Part of it is taking a moment to occasionally ponder what are we doing when we do what we do, and to ask ourselves individually and when we gather as a group occasionally to make sure we got that balance between are we doing the right thing and are we doing it right. So often, unfortunately, people are doing the right thing and are so conscientious about it, but unfortunately the procedures and the busyness of the way that we do things, especially when there's a bit of a crisis behind us, is that we might be doing the right thing, but people criticize it because they see that it's not being done the right way. I can speak really fast, can't I? And I can say, I'm finished, just to say. Thank you.